This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Trey Orndorff, a political scientist at Oklahoma Christian University, and I'm joined by the professor of law at Chase Law School, Ken Katkin. Ken, it's good to be back with you today.
It is. It's great to be back with you again. We've both been on vacation since last time.
Yes. Yeah. And that's a first for a long time for me. So that was wonderful. I hope yours was as good as well.
Oh, yeah. It was great.
So, Ken, this week, as we kind of take back control of the politics guys from the, I don't know if we can call them the older ones, but the other ones, we take it back from Mike and Jay.
They're the old Europe. They're the old Europe. We're the new Europe.
Exactly.
You found Rumsfeld phrase.
Okay. So this week, what New Europe is going to be covering is we're going to be talking about the Fed's historic rate increase, inflation's new high that comes out for May. We're going to talk a little bit and get into what Jay and Mike had talked about, that old Europe, when it comes to what's going to be the effect of this on oil. We're going to move forward. We're going to be talking about the primaries this week in Maine, North Dakota, Nevada, South Dakota, and more, including some crazy things happening in New Mexico. And then we're going to talk about the most recent revelations from the January 6th committee. We'll talk about Trump's 12-page response to that. We'll also talk a look about some of the hangups in the gun bill. And we're going to take a look at this week's Wednesday's executive order on the LGBTQI+. So, we will take just a brief moment, and we'll be back, and that's what we're going to be hitting. Okay, Ken, so this week we had some pretty shocking evidence and that printing money endlessly can increase prices. I mean, I know it's a shock, but we see this in full force this week as the data comes out at the end of last week that inflation has hit an 8.6% increase. That is the highest since 1981. That makes it the highest in the last 4 decades. Then this week on Wednesday, in a belated response to inflation, the Federal Reserve raised interest rates higher than expected by 0.75%. That is the first three-quarter rates increase in 28 years. Now, the reason potentially at least is that in terms of monetary policy, the Fed really only has two primary tools to try to get things like inflation under control. It can make money easier, right? It can lower the rates and increase the amount of money supply, or it can increase the rates and decrease the amount of the money supply. That hasn't happened the way it's supposed to have happened in terms for the Fed. So the hope right now is that by tightening monetary policy more rapidly, you're going to pass those higher rates on to the borrowers, make it more expensive, and change that supply and demand calculus. Now, Ken, what do you think
Yes.
about what's going on in terms of inflation?
Well, you know, I think I have a little more nuanced view of it than you, because, you know, although large deficits certainly have an inflationary effect, and I'm not going to argue with you there, I think they're one of the relatively smaller causes of the increase in inflation that we've seen since a couple of years ago. After all, the deficits have decreased each of the past few years from what they were the year before that, and inflation has spiked now. In a time where deficits are still, you know, very high by historic standards, but lower than the standards of, you know, the last 5 years. And I think, you know, much more of the impact of why we're seeing so much inflation has to do with the twin challenges of the oil shock that happened because all the Western countries rightly are no longer buying oil from Russia, and Saudi Arabia has decided to kind of put the squeeze on us right at the same time. So I think that's one main driver. And then the other main driver would be the continuing supply chain shortages supply chain difficulties that are causing shortages in goods. So I think, you know, what, even if the deficit was zero, I think right now we'd be in a time of very high inflation, although I don't deny that the deficits are making it a little bit higher.
What about, though, on the front, and that's kind of what I was getting there a little bit, at this idea that it has nothing to do with the increased amount of, in this case, not the deficit spending, but the way in which we had spending occur, right? You're putting additional money into everybody's pocket, which creates an increased monetary supply of the money, at the same time as you were having one of the historically lowest long-term rates that we'd seen in a long time. One of the few areas where even like, for example, Mike kind of disagreed with some of Trump's policies on making that money too easy. So while the deficit is a piece of it, what about those pieces?
Well, I don't think there is such an increased monetary supply compared to other recent years. So, I mean, the increase in the monetary supply to some extent can be measured by the deficit. Now, I know there's that's really the fiscal component of it, and there's fiscal and monetary components of it. But the fiscal component of it, the annual deficits right now are running between I got to look at what units these are in. I'm looking at all the deficits. So these are between 1 trillion and 1.1 trillion a year. So as recently as 2009, 2010, 2011, they were running between 1.3 trillion and 1.5 trillion a year, and we were actually in a period of deflation then. So if you think about the deficit, which is fiscal, as being the amount where we're essentially printing money, and our government's printing money and spending it without generating it in taxes. The period that we're in right now is we're doing about 20-30% less of that than we were doing a decade ago, and it never caused any inflation a decade ago, and this is in a enormous economy. The United States GDP is enormous, and these deficits really are relatively small compared to the overall size of GDP.
So again, I hear you coming back to the deficit side. So what do you think about the Fed's monetary policy to raise the interest rates? I know that earlier in the year, when we had talked about this, you had seen, it's going to be under control. It's not going to be a big deal. And as a matter of fact, one of the arguments there was like, look, and even if in the short term inflation is high, people are going to be making so much money, it's not going to really matter. So talking about that some too as well.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, as you recall, we did have that discussion. I had faith in the Fed's ability to raise the interest rates as needed if inflation got out of control. And I think that's actually what we just saw this week. So, if you look at, inflation's too high right now. So the Fed just gave us a record high increase. It's a little bit early to tell. I'm not sure if you're already deeming that a failure, but I'd say if you are, I'd say it's a little bit early to call that a failure. That just happened a couple days ago. It probably will do something. And if it doesn't do enough, they'll raise it again. So I certainly would agree with you that there was a need right now to raise interest rates. And in fact, I was only expecting them to raise it by another half point. The fact that they raised it by 0.75 point, which, as you said, is extraordinarily high. That's very strong medicine, stronger than I would have predicted would happen. But I think that should probably just give everybody more faith that the Fed is willing to use the tools that it has to balance the need to bring inflation under control with the need to not cause a recession. And so they're moving forward with deliberation and carefully, but in the direction that's needed.
Yeah, no. So in response to your question, no, I wasn't trying to argue that I wasn't really trying to argue much of anything yet. That the Federal Reserve, that the Federal Reserve was too late to the game in that sense. But rather maybe that it had not really, in fact, recognized what was taking place, right? So, I mean, now are we doing the proper thing? Yes. But as you're talking about the deficit side spending, and as you rightfully note on that being the kind of the fiscal side of the house, one of the other pieces that I was trying to kind of get at here was to say that could it be the injection of additional funds into the economy at the end of the Trump years, the beginning, only one time with Biden, in the way that we had direct cash payments in a combination with historically easy monetary policy that had They didn't hover it around, well, effectively zero.
Yeah, but, you know, we had both the near zero interest rates for a decade, and we actually had, big deficits for pretty much that whole decade. They were down a little bit in 2014, 2015, but, you know, they were very high from the beginning of the financial crisis in 2009, you know, up through 2013, and then they went very high again in 2017, 2018, 2019, 2020, the Trump years. So we had, you know, deficits very high for most of those years. We had interest rates zero for most of those years, and we had no inflation at all until we had the combination of the supply chain crisis caused by COVID and the Ukraine war and the oil boycotts and the fiscal programs that you're talking about. So I just can't see. I might be repeating myself, but I can't see how it's fair to blame all the inflation only on the deficits or the interest rates when those are actually the things that we've had for more than a decade. And what's new is the oil shocks and the supply chain problems.
No, now, I mean, I think one of the areas where the two of us do, I mean, we always have a lot of agreement here. Yeah, I mean, Biden, we have a smaller deficit today. So again, I'm not trying to suggest that there is a direct correlation between the fiscal deficit in a particular year and your inflation rates, or that, as you rightfully note, you have external factors here that can be part of the explanation for why you have these ups and downs, not just the deficit. Just to be clear, the deficit's not my bugaboo in this one.
Right. Yeah. So I think we probably do both agree, because I also agree that the policies that you're talking about, you know, the very low interest rates combined with the big social spending, I also agree with you that does create inflationary pressure. But what I'm saying is, if we're looking at, you know, right now the inflation rates are around 8%, which are really, you know, very high. I'm just saying I probably wouldn't attribute more than a couple of percents of that to the fiscal policies. And I would say that the bigger pieces of that are coming from the other factors.
Yeah, and it's 8 points. It's 8.6. So yeah, that's now tied into this. Last week, Jay and Mike had talked about, well, on the left, there's a lot of, I don't know. One of the things is always it's always curious which side of the spectrum is kind of having the loudest voices. But on the left, we have a big conversation about, well, really the inflationary problems are part of kind of sometimes called greedflation. And on the show last week, the host took a look and talked a little bit about, well, what could it mean in terms of oil specifically? Now, this week, Ken, you know, Biden weighed into this issue of the intersection of oil companies and gas prices and inflation in a letter he sent out on Wednesday. And he said, quote, "At a time of war, refinery profit margins well above normal being passed directly on the American families is not acceptable," end quote. And so it seems like one of the big attacks on the left is to say, well, a big component of what the two of us have been talking about here, inflation, really comes from greedy corporations or greedy oil companies. What do you say about that and that particular framing?
Yeah, I think Biden's half right, not entirely right. I don't criticize the oil companies for raising the prices, which I think may be implicit in what Biden was saying. But I think that under ideas that are as old as Adam Smith about how a free market works, if you've got an excess of demand over supply, or if you've got a sharp reduction in supply because of something like the Russia embargo, but just as much demand as before, then the price mechanism is going to mean that the price is going to have to float upwards as a way of rationing that scarce supply. So I think that if the prices didn't float upwards, we'd have shortages. So I think it's fine that the price floated upwards. But I also think that what that means when the price floats upwards is that the seller is just making a lot more money than before. So I think Biden's absolutely right about that. So I don't know that I'd call it greed, but I think, you know, that where all the money's going. When the price of gas doubles, the sellers are getting twice as much. And, you know, most of that gas is coming from places like Texas or Canada or the North Sea in England, where it doesn't cost them any more to get it out this week than it did a year ago or 2 years ago. So there certainly is, I think, what you could call a windfall profit there. And I think Biden's absolutely right about that. But I don't see what the alternative is. I mean, I think classical economics tells you either have that or you have shortages.
Yeah, I think what oftentimes, you know, what the Biden view is kind of saying is, well, look, they're getting this kind of excessive profit. In general terms, though, if you don't have the weird structural issues, like, so for example, you're not boycotting Russian oil, what this would mean is that these signals of higher prices are generally signs of, well, it's time to invest more money in this, right? Which then leads to an increase in production and therefore a balancing between that. So if the price comes up rapidly enough, you'll see it flow back down as a result of expanding business. But in this case, these profits aren't things where businesses necessarily want to expand because they're not even sure what that baseline is going to be. If you think back, oil companies, you know, oil was trading negative value during the pandemic. And so once, you know, what do you do with that? Well, I don't know what to invest. And you're right, it turns into profit at this point. So I guess it sounds like you kind of agree, though, that that's what else. I mean, there's not really another option when you have these external forces at bay.
Yeah, I think there's not. I mean, I think I don't really fault the oil companies either for, you know, raising their prices because there's an excess of demand over supply, nor do I fault them for not putting enormous new investment into new oil production. I think they are putting some investment into things like new use of fracking and shale oil to, you know, get different kinds of sources of oil. And, you know, the American, you know, Intermountain West, the Dakotas and places like that are probably benefiting from that right now, that there's, you know, when the oil barrel price gets high enough, it becomes economic to smash up rocks to get oil. Right. So I think there is a little bit of that going on. Certainly car companies are, you know, trying as best they can to put out more hybrid cars and fully electric cars, although they've got supply chain problems in getting the computer chips to do that. So I think there is adjustment at the margins of the type that you just talked about, where businesses that can are reacting to the shifts in demand to meet it in different ways, either through cars that burn less oil, through you know, solar panel companies are doing well putting panels on houses and buildings and things, and you know, different sources of oil are coming on the market. But you know, when you have a sudden shift in supply or sudden shift in demand, then in a free market system, you're going to have adjustments in price. I would also say, and I think I said this to you in an email, but I'll say it to our listeners, I still think that price is extremely low. I mean, I just was on, we mentioned we were both on vacation. I was on vacation in northern Michigan, about 500 miles from where I live in Cincinnati. And I do drive a hybrid gas electric car. But, you know, I put at the new price, which is like $5.25 a gallon, you know, the highest I've probably ever paid, you know, I filled up my tank for about $60. And my wife and I were able to drive 500 miles from northern Michigan back home to Cincinnati. Now, $60 to bring two people 500 miles, you know, I hardly find that something to cry about. I mean, we might have spent that much, you know, just on dinner, you know, at a restaurant. And, you know, I think it's just a much better deal to get to travel that far and that kind of money. So it doesn't really seem to me like gas prices are crazy high when you actually consider what you'd get for that money.
Well, I mean, I think there's both truth and, you know, problematics in what you're saying. I mean, on the true side, I mean, of course, it's phenomenal. I mean, the ability of technology to like deliver us around is incredible. And, you know, as you know, for your car, what kind of hybrid electric? I mean, I know you said it, you know, you have,
oh,
you
yeah,
have
it's a Toyota Camry. I got a Toyota,
but what brand?
Camry.
Like, what is it?
I got Camry. Yeah. Hybrid electric, hybrid Toyota Camry.
I'm always curious in people's choices on that front. But so, yeah. You know, you know, because, well, anyway, but the point being is that, so on the one hand, on the left, I want to say, well, look, you should kind of be happy that you have the particular oil increase prices that you want, because nothing is going to make companies like Ford make more of those kinds of Camrys, or to make more of the Lightning F-150, or the, you know, the Mustang E, than those prices moving higher. I mean, that's what creates a desire to have these kinds of alternatives in a market. So it's always a little, there's a piece of me that's always a little bit confused. I think, well, then why are you, now I get the what, why you do. And that comes back to what you're saying, right? You know, so $60 is a steal in your, for being able to go the 500 miles. But of course, those increased prices in oil, they end up making other things cost lots more money too. And I was laughing just a little bit. I don't mean this in a terrible way, but I can't imagine my wife and I spending, you know, $60 on dinner.
Really?
You know, just, no, you know, for the two of us, you know, with my children, maybe, you know. But, you know, and I think sometimes it can be easy to see who gets priced in and out of those things in markets. Just a thought there. So two thoughts there, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, well, certainly. I of course didn't mean to deny the idea that the increase in gasoline prices is having ripple effects on all kinds of goods in the economy, because goods are generally delivered through transportation mechanisms that need to burn gasoline. And so, you know, some can be delivered to part of their trip through freight rail and things like that, which may burn other sources of energy. But yeah, mainly it's trucks. And so, yeah, that is causing, you know, that's a shock that's causing problems. But I think, you know, I do think it's a short term problem, because for one thing, hopefully the oil embargo against Russia and indeed the whole Ukraine war is going to end, you know, in some near term, you know, maybe a half a year, maybe a year, but that should blow over and we should be able to start buying gas from Russia again. And another thing that can happen is, as we were talking about, the shift in what kind of cars people drive and indeed in what kind of engines are put into the trucks that deliver the goods, is that this oil shock will cause people to switch to types of vehicles that are not going to need to burn as much gasoline. And so that in, you know, in the medium run, the impact of this oil shock should be diminished.
Well, Ken, why don't we just pause for just a moment before we move into talking about the primaries this week? So we're going to take just a brief break here at the midpoint, and then we'll be right back. And Ken and I are going to be talking about this week's primaries. Okay, so Ken, this week, you know, we have all I think of it as being kind of the economic policy side. We have inflation. We talked about that. But then we have the outright politics of the matter. And in this week, we have yet another batch of midterm primaries. And so this leads to all kinds of questions about, you know, what's the weight and the power of the Trump endorsement? What's going on in these kinds of elections? And so this week we had Maine, we had North Dakota, we had Nevada, and we had South Carolina giving their, having their primary, political primaries this week. So what do you think about what was happening in terms of who's winning, who's losing? I mean, a few of the things that I seem to take a look at is, right, in South Carolina, we get Trump's endorsement being split, one victory, one loss. What do you see as being some of the takeaways from the primaries this week?
Yeah, I think they're consistent with what we've been seeing. It looks to me like Trump still has a lot of influence with Republicans, but not enough that he's a kingmaker every time. You know, I think that's kind of been the story this whole spring, and it to me, it continues to be the story.
Yeah, I don't disagree, and it's weird to me because when you take a look at the story, you know, so if you were just to open up, you know, Apple News or your web browser and just kind of take a look, you would see, I think, you know, Vox kind of even put like Donald Trump is still winning. You know, The Hill put it as right that the endorsement still has sway, and that just doesn't seem to be exactly the case.
No, it seems to be. You know, if I was a Republican candidate, I'd rather have Trump's endorsement than not. I think it's a net positive for most of them in a primary, although I think it'll turn out to be a net negative for some of them in a general election. But I think it's not a make or break thing. I mean, Georgia was the biggest example. That's not the most recent one. But, you know, with both Kemp and Raffensperger hanging on in Georgia, I think that really broke the narrative that it's absolutely essential to have the Trump nomination. And even here in Ohio, where Vance won with it, and, you know, we talked about this before, Vance only got about 30 some odd percent of the vote. And, you know, 70% of the Ohioans voted for different candidates, although there were six of them who split the vote on each other. So I think Trump gives a Republican candidate, you know, if I was going to try to, you know, just guesstimate a number, I'd say it's probably worth about 10 points, you know, to have the Trump endorsement. And sometimes that's dispositive and sometimes it's not.
Yeah. Now, what do you think about one of the ones that I took away was not so much the Trump as we've kind of, and you rightfully pointed out, we've already talked about a lot. But the attachment to the 2020 election lie narrative, right? I mean, so for example, Nevada Republicans vote for Adam Laxalt, who is and is a proponent for the 2020 election, or in Nevada, you know, Lombardo, the former sheriff, is running for governor, wins in part by questioning Biden's win in the last election. As a matter of fact, he says, quote, "Your vote hasn't counted for decades. You haven't elected anybody. The people that are in office have been selected. You haven't had a choice," end quote. So what I kind of see is a little disappointing. I was hoping to see this shift as we got deeper into the midterms, but I appeared to be a little bit more pessimistic. Now, what about that, whether you're with Trump or not, this kind of the election is almost being the litmus test for some of these races?
Yeah, well, you know, we've only seen primaries so far. We haven't seen the general. And so I think, you know, the primaries, you know, I think you and I probably both just agreed that these kind of candidates that I think both of us would prefer to see losing are actually, you know, sometimes given a benefit by their affiliation with Trump, and sometimes even a benefit by their affiliation with the big lie. But that probably will become a liability in the general elections. And so, I think the verdict's still out on, what this is all going to mean, because if some of these, you know, sort of mainstream or establishment Republicans are losing their primaries to rabid Trumpers who are propagating the big lie as their main campaign issue, I do think a lot of those people are going to have a harder time hanging on in a general election in a lot of closer states, right? If we're talking about Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, Virginia, you know, those kind of states, I don't think the big lie candidates taking a nomination means that they're going to take a general election.
Yeah, you know, and I mean, I guess in this case, I want to agree with you, but yet. I am just not yet to the point. I think one of the things that concerns me, and this sometimes I can be the positive spin when Micah and I are on the show together, you know, he can kind of get negative on the media side and people's ability to understand and learn things. But I think when I hear your argument, it seems, you know, what you have to hope is that there's still a large enough proponent of Republicans and a large enough we'll call them loose connectors to the party who aren't going to also fall into that category of the election being stolen. So, I mean, obviously you think that's the direction it's headed, but
let me qualify it rather than convincing you. I'm only saying that about close states. You know, I actually think in the states that are definitely going to go Republican, I think a lot of these Trumpers who are running on the big lie are going to win in the general election. I do think that. I just think it's only really in states that are highly contestable where you don't need there to be a lot of moderate Republicans or Republican leaning independents. You know, most of the battleground states, if even 5 to 10% of the electorate falls into those categories, you know, Republican-leaning independents or moderate Republicans. If they would vote for a Republican but not for a Trumpish big lie candidate, it may only take 5 to 10% of the electorate in the battleground states for that to be outcome dispositive. But I'm not making that kind of prediction everywhere. I agree with you that you know, probably out there in Oklahoma where you are, I think, you know, these you know, whoever's the Republican nominee is going to win pretty much all the elections, you know, no matter what kind of Republican they are. And I think that's true in you know, many, many states, unfortunately. So I agree with you there.
No, I have some ends into that. And yeah, for sure. Now, so I mean, that's obviously, those were some of the things that I had seen as being some of the trends. Do you see any other trends overall, or is it still, like you had said at the very outset of talking about this, well, kind of still the same analysis that we've had in the past?
Yeah, I mean, one primary I can't wait to see what happens is the Wyoming House primary, because, clearly most Wyoming Republicans are probably going to vote against Liz Cheney, but Wyoming does allow crossover voting in primaries, and it is possible that enough Democrats and independents in Wyoming will choose to vote a Republican primary ballot, which they're allowed to do without even changing parties, that Liz Cheney may hang on. And I think it's also conceivable, although probably less likely, that if she loses the Republican primary, she would still run as an independent in the general. But I think I'll be very interested to see how that one goes. She's really the only candidate right now who's really, really Republican candidate running in a primary while standing in very vocal and open opposition to Trump. And it'll be interesting to see how that one goes.
No, that's true. You said something there, and I'm not sure if this is something that we're talking about political primaries, and I don't know this is something we've ever explicitly, chatted about on the show, but you had mentioned there for Wyoming that, right, you don't even have to change your affiliation. There's a lot of different kinds of political primaries in Wyoming. Correct me if I'm wrong, Ken, but they have an open, a pure open political primary, correct?
Yeah, per open political primary. That's right. And some okay. States have that. Yeah.
Yeah. What I was going to say was it might just be worth kind of running through just quickly. So if you're listening and you're not quite sure what that means, so because primaries, they're elections, but they're elections for who is going to be the candidate for each party. States have a variety of different laws and rules that deal with this. So in Wyoming, for example, you have open primaries. In Oklahoma, we have closed political primaries. Ohio, I am blanking. What is it in Ohio, Ken?
Ohio actually changed. So when I came here and when you lived, you didn't live on this side of the river, but
I lived on the other side. I was a Kentuckian.
Yeah. So yes. So when you lived in this region and when I moved to this region, you could only vote in your own party, but you could change your party registration at the polls. So if you showed up as a registered Democrat
and you wanted
to vote in a Republican primary, you could, but only by changing your registration to Republican right then and there. Now, they eliminated that a few years ago. And now actually here, as in Wyoming, there are separate Republican or Democratic ballots, but any voter can choose one of them and vote it. And it doesn't matter whether it's in the same party that you're registered in. So as a registered Democrat, if I just simply asked for a Republican ballot on primary day, I could have one even while I remained a registered Democrat. But you only get one or the other here.
Exactly. Okay. So that's, and again, for listeners, that's an open political primary. A closed is where, in advance of the election, you are a particular party. You have to vote. I mean, I'm only going to get the ballot for the party from which I've come. Now, I had forgotten about Ohio, Ken, having been semi-closed. So in a semi-closed, that's exactly what you had described, in which you can change, but it's a public, you're actually changing your registration so that you can do it. There's also some states that have what are called semi-open. And in that case, you can opt to either register as a Republican or a Democrat. But if you register elsewise, then you can also pick the Republican or the Democratic ballot of your choice. So a Republican couldn't pick a Democrat, but a Libertarian, an Independent or a Libertarian could.
The jungle primary. A few have the jungle primary where
that's what I was going to say. Jungle or blanket.
Okay, you tell it that. Yep. Yeah. You tell.
No.
That
go
one.
Ahead. Yeah. You do that one. You do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Where they just put all the candidates on the same primary without regard to what party they're in, and then the top couple of vote getters in the primary run against each other in the election. So they might be both in the same party. You sometimes wind up with Democrat versus Democrat or Republican versus Republican in the general election if the number one and number two vote getters in the primary happen to be in the same party.
Yeah, and that actually led to a Supreme Court case. I believe, isn't that one out of Louisville where they upheld the constitutionality of blanket primaries?
I can't remember if it's out of Louisville. I should know this, but I
No, Louisiana.
Louisiana. Yeah, they've had the Louisiana is one of the states that certainly does use a jungle primary. Actually, I think California does too. But they've had it for a long time. So if there was a Supreme Court case that upheld it, it's a while back because this is a mechanism that a few states have used for a long time.
Yeah, the two first ones are Oregon and Louisiana. They do it a long time. Oh, man, when do they start? This is something that if I was teaching right now, would be on the top of my head. But I can't
States
think
generally
about that.
they do have a lot of leeway to do it how they want. And, you know, I think Maine has ranked choice voting, and maybe a couple other states are moving towards that. So those are different systems for counting the primary votes as well.
Yes, and that's a good point. You know, here we were just talking about not the counting, but rather the mechanism by which, you know, deciding which ballots you're going to get. And again, the reason we were getting into that was what you were talking about. Well, how might that look for, say, Liz Cheney, right? Because she was in an open primary. So I kind of took us down a long rabbit hole, but you were talking about, alluding to an open primary.
If I lived in Wyoming today, and it was time for me as a registered Democrat to go vote in the primary, I would pick up a Republican ballot and vote for Liz Cheney. I wouldn't bother to pick up a Democratic ballot, although I'm a Democrat. So I think, mm-hmm. There may be, she may get a little wind at her back from that. So that'll be very interesting to see.
Another piece of this, so we talked about the lie, we talked about the primaries a little bit. One other, it's not earth shattering, but it is indicative of both the election and some of our concerns about it, is what has happened in New Mexico. So in New Mexico, Ken, this past week, basically we have a county commissioner, Coy Griffin. He is the founder, this might tell you a lot about him, he is the founder of Cowboys for Trump, and more importantly, he is convicted, or is being convicted currently, for his part in the January 6th attack. Now, why is this joker coming into the news cycle this week? Well, it's because he and his commission have refused to certify the electoral votes that have come in inside of their area. So this has led the New Mexico Supreme Court to basically say, look, the commission, you guys have got until Friday to certify the electoral count. Unfortunately, Corley has not, he won't, arguing that there was a hacking and a fraud, just like there always has been going a long time back. As of our time of recording this on Friday, as a matter of fact, he has refused to certify the primary results, which, since he has a midnight deadline today, means that he's probably not going to do it. His only response has been this, quote, "Why have a commission if we just get overridden by the court system?" End quote. What do you think about that as a legal scholar?
Well, I suppose you have a commission that is supposed to follow the law, and then they won't get overridden by the court system. But I am the law. In fact, along those lines, Trey, I looked at the Washington Post article about this, and there was one quote in there that he gave to the Washington Post that really caught my eye. This guy, Coy Griffin, said to the Washington Post, "I tell people, my oath is to the people I represent. I did not take an oath to the state of New Mexico or their election laws." So he's literally saying he's above the law, that he's not going to follow. He doesn't care what the election laws are, or even doesn't owe any duty to the state of New Mexico at all. I don't know how someone gets to be an officer, even at the county level, without taking an oath to support the laws and the constitution of the state that they're an officer of. But he claims he didn't. And I don't even know if he's going to get to vote at all, because wasn't he arrested for the January 6th? Wasn't he on the Capitol grounds trespassing on January 6th and was arrested for that?
Yes, that's what I was saying. Yeah. As a matter of fact, he was in Washington when he made that last statement, he ended up having a charge of trespassing, since he goes up to the building but not into the building, as I understand it. And as a result, gets to go back home.
But is he there waiting for his sentence? Like, I don't think he's in jail, but is he waiting for his sentencing in D.C. right
pled.
Now?
He
pled. So he pled, and he's been sentenced?
I think it's all done, yeah.
Okay. The Post said that he was in D.C. waiting to be sentenced, but I didn't know. That could have happened already, I guess. The Post article was a couple
days ago. I think
there
might have been a little bit of a time lag.
Yeah. Yeah. So my prediction of what will happen here is that the Supreme Court of New Mexico will ultimately certify the election, just on the grounds that it would have inherent authority to do that if this commission keeps refusing to do it, or maybe that it would recognize the validity of the Secretary of State's certification of the county election. I think if it doesn't go that route, then probably the only other route, which seems to me to be a little less palatable, would be for the if they conclude that only the county board could certify the election, then they're going to have to hold these county board members in contempt and put them in jail until they do. But I just feel like that's That seems like more problematic to me than the Secretary of State simply claiming that she can certify the election and then the yeah. court approving that.
On two fronts there, Ken, just to be clear, I popped up Politico, and yes, today, as a matter of fact, he was sentenced to the time he'd already served effectively and is done. So that happened this afternoon.
So he can go back to, he is in D.C. now, but he can go back to New Mexico tonight, you're saying?
Yes, as we speak, apparently, I guess he is on his way to make these big votes. But you lodged it as a little bit of a funny as he was talking about, well, I didn't take an oath, and both of us were thinking, well, I'm pretty sure I've been around. Even when you're going to be a trustee for a university, I'll never forget in Kentucky, all offices, you have to agree that you have not been in a duel or a second to a duel, right? So I'm going to uphold all these things, and I've never been part of a duel before. So it's really, really unlikely that, you know, that's the case. But it is, and this kind of ties into what we were talking about before, a little bit of what worries me on the election front to see which way that moves. Because at some level, I mean, you're never supposed to be incumbent to your vote to your voters, in the sense that they are more important than the Constitution, your state's Constitution, and the law, right? Like, that's what makes a legal rational country a legal rational country in that Weberian sense.
It's the very definition of the rule of law. If we have the rule of law, we have officials who are bound to follow the law.
Yes. And I think that's going to be a piece of what's going to be very, that is what made me, that's why I want you to be able to convince me that that's not the way.
No, I mean, we may have officials like this, but I think, you know, we still have the statewide elected officials, the Secretary of State, and we still have the courts. And so, yeah, I think this kind of sideshow, these kind of antics, I'm sure this is not the last we've seen of this kind of thing, but, you know, we can only hope it doesn't do too much damage to the democracy.
Well, that's the good thing about having a interconnected federal system. Put a plug in for that, right? To have some balances on those things. Okay. Well, Ken, I think we're going to need to pause here and end the ad-supported preview of the politics, guys. So Ken and I, we're going to be continuing to record as this gets done. And if you would like to join us in that, you can, but you just need to become a supporter of the politics, guys. That's what makes this show possible. So if you'd like to listen to the rest of the show, there are other benefits to being a supporter of the show as well. So, for example, you can connect with us on Discord and other ways. So if you want to become a member, listen to the rest of the show, you can head to patreon.com/politicsguys, or you can head to politicsguys.com/support. We're also on Venmo at politicsguys. So if you want to listen to the rest of the show, get a lot of great other items as well. All you got to do is head to patreon.com/politicsguys or politicsguys.com/support.